Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. It's the end of 2013. And we're going to have one of our yearly roundups, and we'll be talking about issues that are unreported this year, events unreported, underreported, or misreported.
As we see it.
I'm Steve Williamson, City Crossing. Guys,
two very interesting guys, by the way. Extremely interesting guys.
And we have in the studio today Gary LeMaster, who's been on the show many times before.
Good morning.
And our eminent Gris, Dick Searle.
Everybody has a rocket scientist in there.
Dick Searle is our personal rocket scientist.
That's right.
If you want to talk to somebody who,
they're just piling on me because this is the first time I've been in here since, I think, January.
That's right.
You want a guy smart enough to design spaceships?
I'm the treasurer, depend on me.
We have an obligation to pick on them. That familiar sound you've heard, ladies and gentlemen. No.
Let's talk.
And Mike has a list of Mike's selection of stuff. And let's do that first. Gary has an important discussion on environmental. Dick and Gary are going to talk about underreporting environmental issues.
Yeah.
Which, when I went on Bill Moyer's website, Bill Moyer's is kind of like the gold standard at issue reporting on television and radio. That was one of the issues that he mentions is the underreporting of climate change. The fact that as more and more scientists have been completely convinced that there's climate change, when you look at the amount of reporting about climate change, it's been going down since 2007. There's less reporting as people become more convinced of it. So I think that's an issue we want to get to.
Yeah, we're going to hit an overview of some of the categories anyway of underreported stories, and then zero in on a few is kind of what we're going to do.
And I want to talk about Benghazi because I still think that Benghazi is the really representative story of what's wrong with American media and with particularly with right wing politics.
Very good. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No.
Mike, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Some of the stuff I got from a website called Project Censored. Walter Cronkite said Project Censored is one of the organizations you should pay attention to. And their list, they have 25 on their list, but they fall into these categories. The widening wealth gap. Now, we've all heard stories on the widening gap in wealth, but just like the environment, it's because it's so important. It's because it's so pervasive, because it affects so many people that, it is considered underreported or slanted in report. Now, Project Censored will not just do underreported stories. Part of their philosophy is also to do things that they think were falsely slanted one way or the other, liberal.
We've been reporting on it for 2 years, haven't we?
That's right. So Democratic Perspective has nothing to be ashamed of as far as Project Censored. The trial of Bradley Manning is one that's on everybody's list for leaking classified documents again. His particular trial, incredibly underreported.
The trial, Mike, is underreported, not the leaking, is what they're saying?
Yes, right, because at the time he was arrested, I think it was covered much better than the trial. Yes, that's the point. On their list is Obama's, to prove that we are somewhat bipartisan on Democratic Perspective, Obama's war on whistleblowers. We may not get to talk a lot about that, but certainly we want to talk somewhat about it. But the hunger strike at Gitmo, the fracking stories nationwide have been considered underreported once again because they affect so many people. People have literally woken up and found they had fracking wells in their communities for 2 years and had no idea when. After they saw maybe a national story.
There's a giant sinkhole in Louisiana, not caused by fracking, but caused by draining gas and oil under the ground. It's now 8 acres of a sinkhole.
Earthquakes in Oklahoma and Ohio as a result of extraction.
Exactly. And the source, the cause being fracking and being underreported. A lot of those communities say they would not have chosen, had they had a choice, but of course they did. There's a couple of stories surrounding Monsanto and the GMOs, of course. One of the fracking stories is fracking and our food supply and how those things are connected. Wireless technologies, the health crisis, at least some people feel there's a health crisis in wireless, all those people tucking cell phones into their underwear and coming up with various kinds of cancer is an underreported story. And I'm going to talk about ALEC. My favorite underreported story is the American Legislative Exchange Council. Anything that, and I think by the end of this, this is kind of like a poetry reading. By the end of this, we're going to see a theme that's going to run through this. And I think anything that touches or doesn't serve corporate interests, miraculously becomes underreported.
If you're not familiar with ALEC, it's an organization that basically allows corporations to write laws, and those laws are then introduced by legislators across the country. And one of the other things is ALEC has come under a fair amount of scrutiny, and they've lost a lot of their funding. But what's happened is that a lot of the corporations that have pulled out of ALEC have redirected their money into another organization that is kind of a spinoff called the State Policy Network. And the SBN is actually growing as ALEC is diminishing in influence.
Well, as ALEC got exposed, and you'll find ALEC exposed all over the internet. As that got exposed, then corporations began to pull out. By the way, APS and Wells Fargo said they pulled out of ALEC, but according to one source, and I haven't had a chance to verify it with a second, is they haven't. They said they were pulling out, and they didn't. APS and Wells Fargo. But certainly a number of, and Coca-Cola being chief among them. And when I get to my bit, I'm going to tell you the corporations that are in, the corporations that are out, and what they do.
Let's go to Gary and let's talk about the broadest underreported, misreported issue or constellation of issues this year. And that's the environment, right, Gary?
Yeah, it kind of, my thinking kind of spun out of the climate change that in the early 2000s, climate change was a big issue in the media. When Obama was elected, there was a lot of hope that we would see some, carbon taxes and ways to diminish the greenhouse gases. But over the last several years, about the only thing that the media has reported about climate change or the environment at all is the controversy. The media loves controversy. And so they tend to focus on conflict between those who are so-called climate change deniers, and those who are adamant that, and which includes most of the world scientists, that we're facing some serious issues in the future. So the media tends to focus on the conflict and not focus on the things that are happening as a result of climate change. And to me, climate change is only one, tiny part of our whole environmental destruction.
Yeah, I was going to say that the public attitudes over time have to go up and down in this regard. And there is actually in the Washington Post, which is where I'm getting most of my information, a series of charts, if you might want to call them, that cover some of this matter of the public. In that regard,
it can actually read charts, folks.
Well,
like the rest of us.
I can follow the lines. But the attitude today is that a lot of people feel there's no imminent threat in their lifetime. So they don't make that a top priority. It is the rise. People are beginning to recognize that and feel that there is actually an imminent, or I should say an increasing threat to their livelihood. On the other hand,
you have a situation that the economic situation has a great effect here. And if you prioritize in terms of what their concerns are, the economy is the top thing. But if you go down the line, you know, reducing federal spending, and of course you can see that in the headlines all the time. And finally, I think you get down here to number 10, I guess it is, and this is addressing global warming. And I think part of that is that people figure that global warming is not here and now, and they're worried about, you know, where the bread and butter on the table is going to be. And that's one of the problems.
They believe it's a long-term problem,
right,
rather than a short-term,
right,
problem.
I think there's a couple of issues about it. One is or attitudes that get in the way. One is this whole negative thing. I don't want to think about what could happen.
Right.
So I, you know, if I don't think about it, it'll go away.
Well, and go ahead.
And the other is the fact that, well, it probably won't happen in my lifetime. It's a future issue. So, you know, I'll worry about it a little bit, but I'm not going to do anything that changes my lifestyle.
I think another thing is it's too big and complicated an issue for me to worry about personally.
Well,
my gosh, the whole climate is changing. I mean, I have trouble, you know, going to the stores and picking out the healthy food, much less figuring out climate change.
And the thing, the really, I think, frustrating thing for me is that people see this as a big hit to our economies worldwide, and you know, this issue that is too big to change. But I look at it as I can point out a book called The Great Disruption by an author named Paul Gilding that is quite optimistic. You know, dealing with environmental issues can be a big boon to the economies worldwide. It doesn't have to be a negative.
No, I want to say that it's not all gloom and doom. One of the last questions was, basically, do you think the federal government should or should not regulate the release of greenhouse gases from sources like power plants? And it really was encouraging that 74% of the people do support that. And that, you know, includes both Republicans and Democrats to varying degrees. It's true that actually the more conservatives are less supportive of such a thing as that. I think in one of the surveys, 85% of the Democrats are supportive or believe in global warming, if you want to put it that way, and like 48% of the Republicans. So there is some partisan aspect there.
There was in the past much less partisan aspect. The number of Republicans that are concerned about global warming was much closer to the number of Democrats. And that's as the parties have become politicized, I don't even know what that is. Polarized, it's become kind of a standard of being a conservative that you don't believe that in man-made global warming, and the evidence doesn't matter. You don't believe in it because you don't want to believe in it.
Well, right? I think there's another thing in here. Maybe there's the small echo of the tobacco controversy about whether smoking is dangerous to your health. In this case, economic interests, let's say the energy industries, when this issue first came up, I think they saw this as a threat to their economic well-being. And I think to a degree they're beginning to, at least now they're talking green, and they are doing some things, and they also are beginning to see that there's some profit in certain areas in terms of renewable energy. So I think that it's gradually swinging over. And of course you've had some of these wild events, weather events, and people have managed to tag them as potentially related to climate change. So people and the whole industry is going to swing in this direction. I frankly I'm pessimistic that we, the United States, by ourselves can really do a lot to change the world situation in regard to, you know, actually, you know, shall we say lessening the effects. Go ahead.
Actually, the United States has done quite a bit. Not enough, but we've diminished our release of greenhouse gases. And so has a number of other countries around the world. The problem is that in the United States, our lifestyle, we have 5% of the world's population in the U.S., and we consume roughly 30% of the world's resources.
Right.
And so it's a totally unsustainable lifestyle. And in the way that if we continue to do it exactly the way we're doing it, you know, we could replace carbon-based fuels with solar and other, you know, alternative energies, and we can maintain our lifestyle by changing the way we go about it. But
it is, as Al Gore said, an inconvenient truth. In other words, global warming and the effects of global warming is inconvenient. Well,
the real problem is that we've become our lifestyle has become the standard for the world. And so as these undeveloped and underdeveloped countries, you know, start to gain economically, like China, you know, they want to basically mimic our lifestyle to a great degree. It can't happen. It's unsustainable.
Well, you know, one thing, actually, there are some benefits that we're seeing. For instance, they call them the CAFE standards or whatever it is for automobiles has resulted in a net lowering in utilization of oil. I don't know the exact numbers, but the result is that part of it is that we are no longer actually a net importer of oil in this country. Just
if
recently.
You don't know the exact number, why are you on the show?
Oh.
I know why they asked me to come here.
So that's
one reason I don't like to come on the show, because these people send out ideas without checking them.
That brings up another issue in the United States, is that there was a poll out recently or a study that shows that more than 50% of the population no longer believe or trust scientists. And trust science. We tend to, you know, science tells us things that we don't want to hear, you know, because it doesn't fit into our belief system.
But when we come to like medicine, suddenly they should trust science.
That is the one exception.
Yeah. But they don't want to hear about global
warming. I've got some numbers on that one.
Okay. I was kidding you about that.
I know you were, but I figured I'd fight back. But, how much do you trust what scientists say about the environment? And right now, let's see, completely a lot is like 26%, 38% are a moderate amount, and a little or not at all is 35%. Let's see, in 2007, which is not a long time ago, but 5-6 years ago, it was 32% completely trusted science. So it's dropped, so to speak, from 32 to 26. And the same thing is, it was 24%. Trusted a little back in 2007, and it's gone up to 35%. I think a lot of this, again, is a lot of this FUD factor that and propaganda, mm-hmm. where if you try to stop something, you disseminate fear and uncertainty in people, and people tend to do nothing when they don't really have faith or certainty in what the results will be. And that's a typical propaganda tactic.
I'd like to get into some issues other than the whole climate change, global warming, because, you know, that has become controversial. It's hard to imagine.
Well, the way you stop something from happening is to make it controversial, right Gary? Mike?
Yeah,
it becomes controversial. Smoking. Is smoking bad for your health? Well, that's controversial. So nobody does anything while tens of thousands of people die.
In the past year, the scientists, you know, scientific community has raised the probability of climate change being human caused from 90% to 95%.
That's right.
Yet the media really didn't even report that. So but it's still, the climate change is only one portion of the environmental destruction. When you look at, you know, things like Mike was talking about, fracking, you know, at the same time we have, you know, and that's definitely polluting our groundwater and our aquifers, which are, you know, hundreds and thousands of years in the making, you know, to, you know, get clean water in an aquifer, filtration through the soil.
But what can be done, Gary, because fracking is so extraordinarily profitable. And if you go to North Dakota, South Dakota, people can suddenly make more than a living wage. They can make, if they'll help with the fracking, if they'll help with the oil sand, you can make $100,000 a year before you're living on $25,000.
Well, I think you can, you can mitigate and you can regulate. And I think the problem is the companies are making money off of fracking. They want to make money. There's no, right now, no economic incentive from their viewpoint to doing it any other way than the cheapest way possible. But there are certain areas maybe you shouldn't do fracking. You shouldn't do it within a certain exactly. range of water supplies. You should be required to treat the water that comes out of this process that's just often just dumped on the surface, and it's got lots of, we believe, very dangerous, poisonous materials. They should be required to release what the ingredients are in these fracking chemicals. The fact they want to keep them a secret is in itself very controversial.
And they changed the law to exempt them from any, legal issues regarding pollution of groundwater.
Yeah, we have no idea what they're pumping into the
ground. Well, a lot of benzenes is one of the major.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's actually, it can't be publicly released. I believe that the information is obviously well known.
It is in other countries. That's the really interesting thing. In Europe, they have to release what the chemicals are, but in the United States, we pass laws to prevent it.
So the point of it is, you know, we can get into the 1872 mining law too, which is sort of the rape of the country, but that's another ongoing.
But the other thing is that you know, a fracking gets, you know, becomes the label for a whole lot of extraction of oil. Like in the North Dakota, that the oil, most of the oil there is coming from shale deposits.
Yeah, tar sands.
Yeah. Well, no, not tar sands. That's something else.
That's still another one.
Shale oil is actually relatively clean, and it's in geological deposits that are relatively stable. You know, one of the problems with fracking is they do it in areas where the geology isn't particularly stable, and that causes all sorts of problems.
Let me ask you both this.
I'd like to get to you know, just a minute, is the tar sands, you know, that is one of the worst. That happens to be in Canada, and it takes actually more energy to extract it than we get back out of it, and we don't even know how to clean it up if we spill it. You know.
So let me ask you. Just, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Gary.
Yes, you.
What would good reporting on the environment over this last year look like? In other words, what should have been reported as big news about the environment this last year?
Well, you know, if I would start with talking about permitting oil companies to continue to drill in deep water. You know, we had the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Once the oil spill started to happen, we realized nobody knew how to stop it, you know, and in a timely fashion. Yet we're permitting people to go back and start drilling in those areas again, still without any way to deal with it.
I think it's important, right? I mean, there are several things in regard to what happened in that blowout, if you will, in the Gulf. Anything like that is a result of several mistakes in a row. It's not any single one. And they were not following procedures.
In a way, it's
like a nuclear accident. They've got lots of safeguards, but once in a while, something in two or three times in a row. So they've got to basically tie them down.
So it's the implications of the oil spill that have not really sunk in.
And it's
there hasn't been the reforms to make sure it won't happen again.
And of course it will happen again, but the point is we can make it so it's much, much less common than it is. And I think the same thing goes with fracking. These people have to accept the cost to the environment. Part of the problem is that in our economic system, the cost of externals is not taken into account. The cost of the environment can't be tied to the cost of operation of the company. So, well, heck, they're gonna use that up because it's free, so to speak. The environment's free as far as they're concerned.
Take the coal industry and the Appalachians. You know, they're using a procedure called mountaintop removal.
You guys can have your review next time.
And they've they've destroyed an area of the Appalachians.
Mountaintop
removal. They've destroyed an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. It's actually about the size of the state of Delaware. and has polluted all of the streams in the area. And they get the coal companies get the profits from extracting the coal, but they don't have to deal with the remediation.
That hasn't been reported.
Yeah. That's right.
My choice is GMO. Millions of people in 50 countries all over the world came out against Monsanto and genetically modified organisms. And it was underreported. I mean, the anger, the public. So I guess if I could put this in one sentence, the public anger against Monsanto was underreported. Both domestically and certainly around the world is my vote.
And what's wrong with GMOs? We're not looking at them, or there's something, or there's a potential. Explain to folks why you're concerned about GMOs, you think there should be more reporting about issues like this.
It seems like something that's going to be in our food that is untested and or not tested adequately, we should at least know about. So the anger against Monsanto and GMOs is that you at least tell us, at least let us know, at least give us the choice to buy genetically modified food. And maybe, modified corn is the way to go. Maybe it'll, it'll make us all smarter and better.
You know what gets me upset about this is Monsanto have it, so you have to buy the corn from them. And they can sue other farmers if some of this genetically modified corn moves over into their field.
When I grew up on a farm, GMO is genetically modified organisms.
Thank you.
But when I grew up on the farm, we would save back some soybeans, for example, for seed for the next year, for the next year's crop. If you do that, you get sued by Monsanto because they own a patent on the soybean seed or on the corn seed. The other thing is that these organisms of, corn has been, modified, they call it Roundup Ready is one example. Mm-hmm. So Roundup is a herbicide to kill, other plants. So they modified the corn plant so that
accommodated,
so that it's resistant to Roundup, and
so they can put more pesticides and stuff on a field.
Yeah, they can sell the corn. They own most of the seed companies.
It's not been modified to make it healthier and have more nutrients and
quite
increase
the opposite.
Your brain power. It's been modified in order to be able to spray more
pesticides, more fertilizers, more herbicides. And they're finding that a lot of reports are that it's less efficient, that it costs more to raise the crops that are GMO, and that they're getting lower yields now from many of
these
crops.
Is, of course, Monsanto's making the money, and so they're going to want to push their process. And
it's gradually diminishing the varieties and the diversity of our food supply. That's one of the biggest issues.
Well, there's a lot of questions, like, if there's an all the fertilizer runoff from the fields that go down the Mississippi and you've got a dead zone.
That is
in the Gulf.
So what they were talking about.
The dead zone is 5,800 square miles.
Oh, you got the numbers this time.
There you go.
What they're talking about is externalizing costs. In other words, and so Gary and Dick are talking about, you have a coal mine and you dig the coal and you make a profit for it and you pay the workers. And you externalize all the cost of repairing all the damage that you did.
Well, the health
cost. Same with oil fields and most extractive industries. You extract a whole bunch of gold from a mountain. It pollutes a river. You don't have to pay to clean up the river.
I think you can see lots of underreported stories here just in the discussion of GMOs. And that's kind of what we're trying to get at here. It's just there's all of this related to GMOs that hasn't been reported.
Well, the carbon tax was an attempt to externalize the cost of CO2 and basically on the environment, the overall cost.
Right.
And that was an economic approach to trying to push things in the right
and
direction.
And that had bipartisan support originally, didn't
well,
it?
Well,
sort of
it did until a number of industries says, we don't like that because that's going to hurt our business. our business, not the public's business.
Suddenly you had Koch refining, paying for studies to disprove global warming and climate change.
Well, that's the Fed factor again. So like 97% of the climate scientists agree. And I mean, peer reviewed, but about 3% are willing to express an opinion that they're not certain. And of course, Koch is going to amplify that. And I use the word Koch as sort of a generic thing here. He spent $300 million, I think, this last year in diverse issues.
And their primary scientist, the guy that they were funding to disprove climate change, actually in his last study came around and admitted that climate change was caused by man.
Is this a study at UC?
I don't remember where it was done. But,
I heard the first preliminary report, and then I never heard anything else. Maybe they paid them off.
They've kind of buried it, yeah.
Well, the famous, for younger folks, the famous example is cigarettes, where the scientists figured out cigarettes were really, really bad for you. I mean, seriously bad. Caused cancer and all this stuff.
They were putting asbestos in the filters.
Yeah, I think we better get on to some of the other issues.
Let's stay on this since we should stay on this, Mike. We can talk about other issues next week.
Oh, there's no lack of underreporting to talk about.
Well, let's try to understand the nature of the underreporting.
Because of corporate-owned... Go ahead.
Okay, you're on. One of the factors is what, Mike?
Corporate-owned media. Corporate-owned media does not look at itself. It becomes... So all of the issues that affect those corporations become invisible. The people in our age bracket know that there was hundreds of news organizations, in the 20th century. And that as the century progressed, then there were fewer and fewer. And then we can name some of the laws and some of the changes in the trade policies of the United States and corporate policy.
Five corporations now own the vast majority of the media outlets.
Exactly. Five, I've heard six. I walked in this morning with the number three, but it's between three and six anyway, when it was hundreds.
So that's one of the factors, right? Yeah. Is that the stories are not being reported because they're not in the interest of the corporations who either own the media or who have a lot of political influence to report them. I mean, if you're a cigarette company, the last thing you want is people talking about how cigarettes are going to kill you, right?
I would love to be able to sit here and read all of the media outlets owned by Rupert Murdoch. It would take, 3 or 4 minutes to read them all. The TV stations, the print outlets, the internet sites, and we can do this for the three to six corporations, and the list goes on for hundreds of media outlets. So yeah, you're getting your, and those people are not godlike. They protect their self-interest.
They've always claimed that there's a firewall between the organization itself and the news gathering portion.
There was a decision, a conscious decision I made, 15 or 20 years ago, that news would come under entertainment.
That's right.
It used to be a separate operation of the networks.
That leads to another issue is what they call the 24-hour news cycle, which is you have to generate a story, and you can see this repeated again and again this year. People reporting stuff, misreporting the attack in Boston. A newspaper put picture of the wrong people as the terrorist on the front page. This is a rush to judgment, a rush to beat the next guy to the news. Part of the problem with the 60 Minutes story on Benghazi was they wanted to have an exclusive and come up with all kinds of new stuff, and the guy was sort of lying to them, professionally lying to them, and they didn't check. They wanted the story.
So. I think the important thing is that they correct themselves. You never hear them come back and say, oh, we were wrong, and get that much.
60 Minutes, for example, with the Benghazi story, did 60 Minutes, basically.
Sorry about that.
On Benghazi, on basically blaming the State Department and the administration. And then they did about 30-second retraction on an ensuing show. So that's often how it goes.
Well, it is part of the DNA of journalists and journalists and pseudo-journalists. It's I worked at both the Pretty Independent and the Red Rock News, And you know, these are what papers come out two or three times a week, and they go nuts when they can beat each other to a story. Rather, you know, we talk about a nanosecond news cycle on the world today, and these guys come out two or three times a week, and even they take a great deal of satisfaction in quote unquote beating each other.
Well, then going back to things like the tobacco industry, when you have a few corporations owning most of the media, and they're making their money off of advertising, when the news stories start to cause problems with their advertisers, the corporations now start to contact the news people and say, hey, let's change that, or let's drop that, or let's bury that story.
Since you mentioned the Benghazi story, I'd like to talk a little bit about
it. Go for it.
There's a new article in the New York Times.
Excellent.
An extremely well-written article by a man named David D. Kirkpatrick, and he was a longtime media writer for the New York Times. He's been a writer for 20, 30 years, never had any problems with his reporting, spent a year working on the story about Benghazi. I keep coming back to Benghazi because I think it reveals the corruption really of the Republican Party leadership, and particularly the extreme right of the Republican Party. And Kirkpatrick's story is probably the most accurate story we're going to see about Benghazi. It feels true. One of the problems we have, and the language we're talking about terrorists, comes from people who never were in a political movement, who have no intuitive feel for how these things work. And so they talk about franchises and so forth and so on. They don't understand how these things happen. And Kirkpatrick's story goes back to the film. There's a film made just sort of deliberately to insult Muslims and the Prophet. It's a little internet trailer that pretends to be the trailer for a large feature film that doesn't exist. The fellow who made it is now in jail on other charges. The film starts riots in a half dozen or more countries. The biggest one, the most dramatic one, is in Egypt, right next door to Libya. And Benghazi has almost no media of its own. They rely almost entirely on Egyptian media for all their information. So Kirkpatrick goes back and he looks at what happened, and his reporters, it's a fairly large report with a lot of people involved, and they go back and look. And so there's two divergent stories. One is the first story told not only by the American administration about a spontaneous attack with terrorist elements joining in, but it was told by all the news media I could check on. It was told by the Chinese and French news media. That goes down. And the other one is the Republican story that was always a highly planned Al-Qaeda attack that the administration was somehow undercover. What Kirkpatrick finds is that the attack is led by an eccentric, isolated, violent Islamic extremist who would have no power in a normal situation. The other militia leaders think he's a little crazy, but because of the chaos of the situation, because he spent years and years in prison that Gaddafi sent him, he has a certain amount of cred with a small group of young men. And so he has 40 followers. The film comes out. These people have wanted to attack American interests in Benghazi for quite a while. And when the film comes out, they do so. It's not a coordinated campaign. There's two areas in Benghazi of American control. One is the embassy compound, and the other is the annex where the CIA office is.
Which was six blocks away.
Yeah, which is six blocks away. So if it was a coordinated attack, all the Navy SEALs are sitting in the CIA, and you're going to attack them first, and then you can do whatever you want to the compound. But it doesn't get attacked until much later. So it seems completely improvised, just as the sort of administration suggests. It seems provoked by this film. There's no, Kirkpatrick could find no Al-Qaeda as an organization, no Al-Qaeda involvement at all. it's Islamic extremists, much like Al-Qaeda, who are leading the attack. The other militia, the pro-American militia, because there's a rumor that the American guards have killed Libyan demonstrators, refused to intervene. It's not even like they attacked the museum, the compound. They just raised their hands. Well, they've killed the Libyans and we're staying out of this. If we go in there and we kill Libyans to protect Americans, then we're going to get into a blood feud with the other Libyan. And so they stand aside. And the people that the Americans expect to come to their rescue don't do it. The Libyan militia, who they think they have a relationship, don't come to their rescue, don't help, because of the complex problem. And it's, I see this going back to Vietnam, when the United States goes into Vietnam and they have no idea who the Vietnamese are, who the Vietnamese think they are. They have no idea of Vietnamese history. They have no idea of Vietnamese relationship with China. And we jump in without any kind of information. And here we have a situation where the American embassy, and it's probably part Stephen's fault, who's the ambassador, overestimates their connection with the Libyan militia that the United States has been funding.
One of the issues was that they were eager to, you know, become friends with Libya and to help establish a pro-American government in Libya. So, you know, Stevens was very, you know, tied into a lot of the power base of Libya, and they were hoping, you know, I think they were optimistic, and that was probably led to part of the problem.
They were too optimistic, and Stevens is the opposite of the ambassador sitting around in his residence. He's a proactive organizer. He's worked in Benghazi. He goes to Benghazi to get things going. But they don't understand Libya. They don't understand the relationships of the militia, and they don't understand the interpersonal relationships of the militia leaders. And the militia leaders may think the guy is crazy, but thinking a guy is crazy, off the wall, isolated and weird, is different from being willing to shed blood to get rid of him.
So that's what's behind the Benghazi thing, where finally we can
It sounds true to me, Mike. It sounds like an expression of the chaotic situation
we
saw.
And it finally got reported. The stories that we're not talking about are that a fifth of Americans are going hungry. I'm going back to Project Censored. The stories we're not talking about is that the U.S. has left an epidemic of cancers and birth defects in Iraq. The stories that nobody's talking about is a culture of cruelty on the U.S.-Mexican border. The stories that haven't got covered are the guys out at the coffee shop are a lot of conspiracy theorists, but the trillions that the richest 1% are hiding in tax havens around the world, all these trillions that are supposed to be stimulating the economy are hidden. The hate group growth in the United States since Obama got elected in 2008 rised sixfold in his first administration and is doing nothing but rising constantly. We got a minute left. Obviously there is lots of underreported stories. Why is there so many? Because they don't, and I think the theme that I predicted at the beginning, they don't serve corporate interests. We have, our organizations to thank for helping us, do our little, song and dance here on Monday mornings. We have Democrats of the Red Rocks, which have great movies and great breakfast every month. Go to the website, find them. You can find this and all the other great, podcasts, the great shows on vvid.org.
And don't forget Democrats of the Verde Valley in Cottonwood.
And Democrats of the Verde Valley. Don't forget them.
Yeah, I'm having trouble forgetting them right now.
We don't want to forget them. So, yeah, those guys help out. Democratic perspective. Obviously we need another show.
Yeah. And this is a show produced entirely by us. When we say independent Democrats, we mean exactly that.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.